for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Senator Barbara Boxer, chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, says she'll introduce the Senate's climate control bill in early September. But with the health care debate and other meaty issues on the table, its prospects are unclear. Senator Boxer joins me in the studio to talk about climate change, health care, and realities in the Senate, as well as her new novel about, you guessed it, a liberal Democratic senator from California. Her new book is titled Blind Trust. And, of course, you're invited to join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Senator.
Good morning, Diane. It's lovely to see you again.
So good to see you. First, I'd like to ask you about former President Clinton's private mission to North Korea. What do you think happened before he went, and what do you think happens as a result of the fact that he came back with those two young women?
Let me just say, first of all, how relieved I feel. Senator Feinstein and I wrote a letter to the president, along with about seven other colleagues, a couple of months ago, actually, because they've been there for a while. And we said, please send a special envoy. How this came about, we'll all find out. But I know there was just building pressure to do something. These two young women were sentenced to 12 years of hard labor. My goodness. One of them, a mother of a four-year-old. And it was getting increasingly frightening as we were, I think, seeing relations between our two countries just get colder and colder. So I think the president, President Obama, handled it just right. This was a private mission. Therefore, it doesn't have ramifications on a government-to-government relationship on other issues. But it certainly was good that it succeeded, and it certainly isn't going to hurt with future relations.
Do you assume that former President Clinton went with the approval of President Obama and the approval of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
I would say that they were careful to say before he left that it was a private mission. Of course, they were aware of it. This has happened before. We've seen Bill Richardson go over there on, quote unquote, a private mission. And I think that's an important distinction. But the bottom line, frankly, for me today is seeing these two young women leave there and come back home to my state and know that we didn't lose anything by this at all.
And yet, that is what many commentators will say, that photograph on the front pages of every newspaper in the country showing Bill Clinton sitting next to the leader of North Korea with his aides, with Bill Clinton's aides in the background, is in and of itself a concession.
Well, I just say, look at the face of President Bill Clinton on that. They weren't exactly sitting next to each other.
Nor was he smiling.
This was not a warm and fuzzy moment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what you're bringing up is what we had the last 8 years with George Bush. I mean, they were, I think, very concerned about the symbolism of doing anything with people who we don't agree with. And, you know, I think, what did we lose? We got these two young women back. The president's face, President Clinton, certainly told a story. He went on this mission. He freed the young women. Kim Jong-il, what's he going to gain from this? He will gain much more if he engages in nuclear non-proliferation talks. So I'm of a mind that we gained the release of these two women, and I think we move on. It doesn't implicate us into anything else. It doesn't say that we're soft on North Korea or anything else. So I think it was a good thing, and I'm very happy. As I said, seven or eight of us did call on the president to appoint a special envoy, and this was handled well because it was a private mission.
Now, do you think there are implications for future negotiations over nuclear ambitions, nuclear relations with North Korea on the basis of the fact that a former president did sit down with Kim Jong-il?
Well, this is up to Kim Jong-il. If he wants to join the community of nations, he has to make the decision. We're not going to soften our attitude toward them and their nuclear ambitions. So this is up to him. I mean, if he decides he wants to join the world, that would be a good thing for his people. It would be a good thing for the world. This is a decision he'll have to make.
Is this an opening toward that?
It's up to him. It's up to him completely.
Totally up to him.
I think so, yes. That's why this was a private mission. Nothing else was discussed.
Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat of California, novelist as well. I have in front of me a copy of her new book. It's titled Blind Trust. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. There are so many things going on in this world. So many problems, healthcare, climate change, everything. But you have time to write novels, and you have the desire to write novels. Tell me why.
Well, writing is what I like to do the most. It is my hobby. I was a newspaper reporter. I wrote in-depth stories way back before I went into politics. I even did a radio show for a little while.
I didn't know that.
Yes, I did. For KGO Radio, I was their filler-inner in the middle of the night.
I see.
And I was in local government at that time. And I thought, well, maybe after just a few years in local government, I will, you know, do my writing, do some teaching, do some radio. Well, you know, that didn't work out that way. I ran for Congress. I ran for the Senate. No one ever thought I'd win any of that. And I wound up winning 11 elections or something. And it's been fantastic. But this desire to write has never left me. I wrote a nonfiction book when I got into the Senate called Strangers in the Senate, which really started off about the Clarence Thomas hearings when I was over in the House. And they weren't going to hold any hearings into the charges of Anita Hill, when several women in the House walked over to the Senate and our picture was captured walking up the Senate steps.
I remember that very well.
When we got up to the top of the steps and we knocked on the door, literally, this is what we were told. And we were 10 women from the House. They said, "We don't let strangers in the Senate." And it turned out that that was the way they spoke historically about people who were not senators walking into a Senate meeting. So I wrote this book called Strangers in the Senate. And it was good. It was a wonderful experience. I don't know how good a book it was, but for me, it was sort of half autobiographical, but mostly about issues. And then some years later, I have a friend, now a friend, then I didn't know him, Richard North Patterson, who writes these books that I love because they're good stories, but you always learn something about the world he's engaged in. So in the beginning, he wrote about politics, then news people. And I started to say to myself, I could write, I think, a pretty good story with the background being politics. So I met him and he said, and I told him my idea for my first book, A Time to Run. And he said, "You know, I want to introduce you to my agent, Fred Hill." And he introduced me to Fred. Fred said, "I think you can do this." Well, to make a long story short, it took me so long to write that first novel. By the fifth year, I was struggling.
Oh.
I had finished it, but it wasn't really right. I mean, the story was good, but it was laid out in a linear way. I didn't know really how to do my voices. I didn't know how to do the flashback. I wasn't ready to be published. So I said to Fred, "You've got to give me someone to work with." And he said, "No." And I said, "Yes." So I met this wonderful woman who's British, Mary Rose Hayes.
Yes.
She's also been published, and she teaches journalism. We turned out to be just the perfect pair because she did not know much at all about politics. Of course, I had never written a novel, so we were a good partnership. We respected each other. So we teamed up, and then I finished that first novel. And for the second novel, it only took 3 years because we worked out storyboards and together. We collaborated in a much better way.
How wonderful.
So that's it.
I'm delighted that you did finish it. You grabbed me from the first page with Senator Ellen Fisher Lind, who is a widow. She has replaced her husband, who was a senator, who was killed in a crash. She is married to a very wealthy man.
A Republican,
a
moderate
Republican
congressman.
Who has just finished his term, and his money is in a blind trust, the title of your book. But in that first chapter, the headlines break open the money that belongs to Ellen Fisher Lind as being part of oil company
yes.
ownership. Big problem.
Big problem, because she is such an environmentalist, and she's bashing the oil companies, and she's talking about alternative energy. It also turns out the blind trust invested in alternative energy. She just looks so bad. And here's the thing about a blind trust. The reason you put your money in a blind trust is so that no one can ever find out, and you can never find out what's in it. And here it's splattered all over the front pages.
Senator Barbara Boxer of California. Her new novel is titled Blind Trust. She's written it with Mary Rose Hayes. Stay with us. And if you've just joined us, California Senator Barbara Boxer is with me in the studio. In addition to all the other things she has on her plate, like climate control, health care, a myriad of issues, she loves to write, and she has just come out with her second novel titled Blind Trust, a book she's written about a female senator from California who finds herself under attack for all kinds of shady doings that we'll find out may or may not reflect accurately on herself. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. There's been lots of talk, Senator Boxer, about cash for clunkers.
Yes.
Is the Senate going to appropriate and offer more money for the program?
I believe we'll do it. And if we do, it would be quite a reversal on the part of many senators, because I know that I was a little concerned about
yeah.
it. I voted for it initially, but I thought, is this going to really be a clunker for a clunker? Because the way it was written, you could turn in your clunker, but you only had to buy a car that did 2 miles better per gallon. And I thought we were wasting an opportunity. But what actually happened was kind of amazing, that the average increase in fuel economy turns out to be 9.6 miles per gallon, almost 10 miles per gallon. In other words, people are going in and they're trading in some very fuel inefficient cars for some very fuel efficient cars. 250,000 cars were sold through the program in just that short period of time. Half the new vehicles are from the big three. The number one seller, the Ford Focus.
The Ford, yes.
Pretty amazing. And even of the non-big three purchases, we believe more than half were actually manufactured in the U.S. If we really want to continue stimulating this economy, this is working, and we need to stimulate this economy. We all know what trouble our car companies have been in and our dealerships. So we're going to take the money out of another program so we don't add to the deficit and pump it into this.
Of course, the question on everybody's mind and certainly on those who oppose the program is, how come you're helping out cars? Why not other kinds of businesses? Why not put your money into small businesses?
Mm-hmm. Well, Diane, I would say this. We are coming out of the worst recession since the Great Depression, and I do believe that we could have gone into a Great Depression if we didn't act to shore up the financial institutions, as difficult a vote as that was, horrible vote, and also this stimulus, which was another very tough vote. But clearly, we know that automobile sales were kind of leading this terrible recession. And this is true worldwide. You know, we got this idea from the Europeans. This did not get started in this country. So it worked over there since the taxpayers own a lot of two out of the three big three. I think this is a situation where we want to get paid back. We want to move forward. And I think, you know, yes, we need to help small business too, and we're going to. We're going to have more credit available for small businesses. But I think this is an obvious place where it really does work, and it really does help, and it really does not only help the auto companies, but all the communities that have been so impacted by the lack of sales.
Why do you think we find ourselves in this terrible situation?
Well, there happens to be a global recession, but I think more than that, clearly the housing bubble was allowed to get out of control. You know, in the mid-90s, we gave Alan Greenspan, we the Congress, the power to go ahead and look at all of these mortgages, these subprimes, these predatory lending schemes. And frankly, he never did it. He never looked at it. And these mortgages got out of control. And it started this whole terrible downturn because, as you know, securities were based on these mortgages, and the mortgages were chopped up into many pieces. There were derivatives on derivatives and insurance on insurance, all from a house. And it was a tragedy. Once the housing market slumped as it did, it was a house of cards. So I think that's what exacerbated this worse than other countries.
Do I not recall that Alan Greenspan did, in fact, warn about the housing bubble and did caution that these mortgages were spinning out of control?
Well, there's a difference between warning about a bubble and doing something about it. We gave him the authority to stop these predatory mortgages. He had it right in front of him in the law, and he did not do it.
So you think Alan Greenspan is largely responsible for what has happened?
Of course I know. He's not the only person. The point I'm making is there is a global downturn. You asked, why is it worse here? I said because of the terrible housing bubble. And I think it could have been softened. It doesn't mean it would have been stopped, but it would have been softened if some of these predatory lending practices had been stopped. We still would have had a housing bubble because prices were going up at a ridiculous rate, unsustainable. But I think it's important that we look at what laws were on the books and were ignored. And that's one example, and not too many people pointed out. But it was important because you have to remember, under the Clinton administration, it was Bill Clinton and the Democratic Congress with the Republicans who actually tore down a lot of the walls that separated banking from investment banking. And I voted no. Only 11 of us voted no. I wish I would have been more outspoken. I did vote the right way. Byron Dorgan was a leader on that. He predicted all of this. because we just tore down the walls. And that made it all the more important to give the Fed this power to intervene in these predatory markets. And Bill Clinton, to his credit, signed that bill. But look, I'm not saying Alan Greenspan alone. I have to say, why didn't I call on him to do it? I didn't. But I did vote for the law. But maybe I should have said, and why aren't you doing it? Hmm. I fell asleep at the wheel, too. But we are where we are, as my daughter always tells me. And we are in a place where I think we have averted the worst of the crisis. We're climbing out of this now. You know, I give this administration a tremendous amount of credit. It takes courage to do something. The easiest thing is to pull the covers over your head and say, you know what, just let it go. And we didn't do that. And I don't think this president's getting enough credit yet, but I think he will.
There is some concern, great deal of concern, as a matter of fact, about bonuses going to some of the top executives at some of the banks that were involved in the kind of lending you're talking about. What can be done about that? The American public is outraged over that.
They should be outraged over it. They should also be outraged that the CEOs of the health insurance companies make $20 million a year. But we'll get to that later. Let me say what I think can be done. Number one, my belief is if you owe any money to the federal government, then you shouldn't pay your top executives more than the president of the United States makes. That's my belief, and I would vote for that.
Secondly, how much does the president of the
makes about $400,000, I think, at this point.
And some of these bonuses top $1 million apiece.
Oh, well,
if
more
not
than that.
More.
Well,
if
more
not
than
more.
That. Tens of millions sometimes. Yeah. So that's number one. I don't think you should be allowed to do it. Secondly, when you pay back the government, you're on your own. I don't want to dictate to people what they can pay. But I think the stockholders, the shareholders, should have a say in it because their concern is the future of the company. So they ought to have an ability to vote on these outrageous bonuses, and I would support that. In addition, I also would support limiting what you can deduct as a tax deduction from a corporation if they pay, you know, multi-millions. They shouldn't be able to have a deduction for that. Now, that's my plan. I don't know how we'll resolve all this, but we're going to look at financial reform.
How forceful will you be this time?
More forceful. You know, people say, do you ever regret things? Yes, I regret things. I regret that I didn't say, why aren't we cracking down on predatory loans? I regret that I didn't say that. I regret that even after voting no on the war in Iraq, I should have been down there every day making my voice louder and stronger.
Why didn't you?
I thought that I said enough when I voted no, and I continued to speak, but not loudly enough and not clearly enough. And, you know, that's why I like this novel, because Ellen's my hero. She does everything right. I don't.
That's quite an admission.
Well, it's true.
All right. Speaking of Iraq, there is some talk that the U.S. may, before its planned deadline, pull its troops out and declare victory. What's your thought?
Well, that is definitely some of the advice we're getting from some of our military people. I think it's time to leave. I thought it was time to leave before. So much blood and sweat and tears and guts have been left there. And I just have a view of this, that the people of Iraq have an opportunity now to build their own country.
They're still killing each other.
Well, you know what? The people of Iraq have to decide if they want a country or they don't want a country.
And
we can't decide it for them.
And what about Afghanistan, which so many people are saying is becoming or has become Obama's Vietnam?
Well, I certainly don't think that's the case at this point. He just has been president for 5 months, I think, maybe. Six months.
Six.
So how anyone could say that when the Vietnam War went on forever? First of all, my own view is I said publicly that I give the president and this administration a year to see if we can move this Afghanistan situation into a better place.
And if not?
Well, if not, then I don't think military is the way to go. But let me just say this. I knew about the Taliban many years ago before most people knew, because I have some fabulous constituents who came to see me, the Fund for the Feminist Majority, and they brought with them a burqa. Now, I'd never heard of a burqa. I never heard of it. This was so long ago. And they came to me and they said, put this burqa on. I said, oh, this is terrible. What is this? And they said, well, this is what the women of Afghanistan have to wear. And I put this burqa on, and Diane, I don't know if I had it on for 4 seconds. I threw it off. I said, this is the most frightening thing. And the reason it's so frightening, beyond the fact that you feel suffocated in it and you can barely see out of it, is that you know you've now disappeared. You are gone. You are nothing. You are a nobody. You're a blue burqa. And that was the color of that burqa. And I said, what? And then they taught me about the Taliban. And they said, you need to carry legislation that this country will never, ever recognize the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. And of course, at that time, they were saying they were. This was under Bill Clinton. I carried the legislation. I got a Republican co-sponsor. I think it was Sam Brownback. Pretty sure it was. We passed it. We never recognized the Taliban. And then under George W. Bush, we got it done again. And then what I call the accidental liberation happened after 9/11, when we went into Afghanistan and we could have finally made the difference there. So my heart breaks for the women there. My heart breaks for the girls there who are trying to go to school and get acid thrown in their face. And yes, I'm willing to give it some more time because I think those poor people have been so hurt over these years with false promises. So I want to give a little more time.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And you're talking about perhaps a year.
Yes.
The president
For
is
me.
Talking about perhaps a year.
Well, I'm talking about a year for my vote because we're losing our soldiers.
We certainly are.
And it, you know, again, I lose sleep over that. And I am just saying I am willing because I feel it's very different than Iraq to me. First of all, we know Osama bin Laden, if he's still around, is right there. We know we took our eye off the ball after 9/11. We should have kept it on Afghanistan.
And
that was the place to go.
And people now say we really ought to be concentrating on Pakistan rather than Afghanistan.
Well, they're very related. They're very related. So, look, I believe I'm giving this president a year to see if we can figure out a way to build some confidence over there, to get the people of Afghanistan to understand that if they work with us, you know, they can have a life finally.
Let's talk about health care.
Yes.
What is the president likely to concede? What is he likely to get?
Well, I'm not going to speak for the president. I did have the honor of seeing him yesterday. He invited the Democratic members over for lunch. It was his birthday. It was a sweet experience. And he talked about the need to fulfill our campaign promises for change. And he said, we can't really have a strong economy unless we fix health care and make sure that we get on the path of energy independence. I was very pleased to hear him. He's very courageous, and he said we can't be scared because people are ginning up these protests at these town halls. You know, there's actually a website that says how to embarrass your congressman. I mean, can you imagine? And you know, I have seen the mob at work at meetings before. I've seen that happen. It's very
experienced
difficult.
That yes. yourself.
Oh, I have. And
tell me how that works.
Well, here's what happens. You know, you have some organized protesters who come in, and because this is a great and free country, if all they do is yell and scream, they can stay there. No one can kick them out. One time I had a gentleman come in a mask, and he sat in the front and he threw dollars at me. It was unbelievable. And every time I tried to talk about this, you know, he just threw dollars at me, you know, and his message was that I'm a corrupt person. And I said, I said to the police, can you escort this gentleman out? It's very difficult. And he said, no, we can't, because he has a right to protest. So he's in the mask and he's throwing dollars. And the crowd was mortified. And I figured the only way to go is to have the crowd help me. So I said, you know, how many of you would like this gentleman to stop throwing dollars at me, make-believe dollars? And they all said, yeah, stop throwing dollars at our senator. And then I said, and don't you think it's cowardly to keep a mask on? If you don't like me, let me see who you are. We'll talk. And then the guy got very quiet, and he didn't take off his mask, but he just sat there the rest of the time. But the crowd came to my rescue. But a lot of these town halls now,
exactly,
there's so many people. So, you know, the only thing you can do is roll with it and keep your dignity.
All right, we'll take a short break and then we'll open the phones for your comments for Senator Barbara Boxer of California. Her new novel is titled Blind Trust.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Kaufman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kaufman.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Wessel describes the players in politics behind the Federal Reserve's efforts to rescue the U.S. economy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. Senator Barbara Boxer is with me. She, of course, not only does a great deal of work in her position as senator from California, she's also a writer. She doesn't play golf. She doesn't have time for tennis. She does love to write, however. So her newest novel is titled Blind Trust. Here's an email from Mark in Cincinnati, who says, we as Americans spend one of every $6 earned on health care, but not every American is sick. Most are healthy and rarely need doctors. Thus, it is the small percentage of Americans who need medical care who are the ones that put forth the amount of money that averages out to one in every $6 earned by every American. I have health insurance, yet the cost of a single tendon in the shoulder surgery has cost me nearly $7,000 when therapy, medication, and surgical procedures are included. What are we going to do about health care, Senator Boxer?
Well, let me say that we know prevention is the name of the game. That's number one. And that I believe any bill that we pass, and I do believe we will pass a bill, will stress prevention. I think this is right. Five diseases cause 70% of the problem. And I think you probably could guess them. Let's guess them. Heart, lung, pulmonary, stroke,
cancer,
and diabetes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we know that most of these, through diet and exercise and lots of other things, checkups in the right time frame can really change things. So the cost is so high because a lot of people wait and they go to the emergency room. This is the problem. So I think there's no question that we can, what they say now is the fashionable term, bend the cost curve.
Yeah.
By making sure we stress prevention. We also need, let's call it this, health insurance reform. We need to reform. We have caps on our policies that are horrible. We have companies that walk away from us when we do get sick, or they say you can't get coverage except for an exorbitant amount because you have a pre-existing condition. Here's the thing. We spend twice as much on health care per person than most other industrialized nations. And I'm going to ask you a question. See, I'm turning the tables on you,
Diane. Okay, go ahead.
Where do you think we rank out of 30 industrialized nations on infant mortality?
We rate about 27th.
29. You're so close to being right. And where do you think we rate out of 30 on longevity?
I think we rate about 27.
You're close, 24. Mm-hmm. So we spend twice as much and we have much worse outcomes. And it's because we have an insurance industry, I believe, run amok. And we can fix it. We should have a public interest option to keep the insurance companies honest. I'm not wedded to how it has to look. But if it's done without any subsidies and it's just competing, we'll see these costs come down. And, you know, the insurance companies don't like to hear about it. But the fact is, listen to what happened to their profits. Between 2000 and 2007, insurance company profits rose 428%. That's the average, 428% increase in profits. Now, you talk to any small business in that period, please. And we know that the CEOs of the top seven for-profit private insurance companies pocketed $14.2 million in total compensation. I could give you the list.
Okay.
Some of them $25 million. So we need to have reform.
Okay. Let me ask you about the conference call that Karen Ignani, the chief lobbyist for the health insurance industry, did yesterday, which was in the first section of the New York Times this morning, saying that the health insurance industry had stepped up to the plate early on, said it would support reform, and was going right along with President Obama's plans. And now, as Democrats, you seem to have turned against the insurance industry. How do you respond?
Well, I respond this way. If the insurance industry is willing to work with us to make sure there's more competition and we have a public interest option which keeps them honest, that would be great. But that's the heart of it. You're not going to keep the insurance companies honest unless you have this competition. So all we're suggesting is that we have that competition. Some have said it should be a government option. Some people say it should be a nonprofit option, a co-op, for example. This is the way to go. My understanding is they vigorously oppose it. And, you know, look, the insurance companies have a lot to gain by insurance reform because there are 48 million uninsured Americans, many of whom would buy policies from them. If they're going to fight us on bringing down the cost here, now you have to know, this will absolutely blow your mind unless you've heard it already. We just saw a very important study that said in California, if nothing is done, if we pass on this and we let the screamers out-shout everybody else and we do nothing, the average family in California will be paying 41% of its income on premiums. If you live in Pennsylvania, the study says 50%. This is how it's gone. The insurance companies have seen 100% increase in premium cost to families in 9 years. If they want to work with us, my arms are wide open.
What about those people who say, my insurance is fine, I want to keep my insurance, stay out of my personal business?
Well, they should be happy, because that's the first premise of the president and the Democrats. We say, if you love your policy and you're happy, fine. All we're going to do is try to make sure that you can keep it by not having you have to pay 100% more for it in a few years.
All right, let's go to the phones to Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Well, good morning to y'all. This is an important discussion that continues to go on and on. And I just want to say, if I can be quite clear and precise in just a short period of time, that the insurance companies are a huge problem here. And along with that, I want to say that, you know, health care really shouldn't be looked at as a business. It should be looked at as firefighting or police work. I think this whole premise of insurance companies, you know, being such a huge pawn in the game is the main problem.
And you, I gather, Senator Boxer, would agree with that.
Well, I'm not ready to say that there's no place for private health insurance companies, but I'll tell you what I am ready to say. They need to be responsible, and they need to embrace reform, and they need to compete with a public interest option so that we don't have our families going broke over their health premiums.
All right, to Dallas, Texas, and to Brian. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I had a question for Senator Boxer. The company I work for is self-insured, and Aetna Insurance administers all of it, the benefits. How is the new plan, what's in the plan that's going to affect that?
My understanding, first of all, everyone has to know that there's no final bill yet. That's really key.
Exactly.
Everybody's talking about it.
Exactly.
First of all, the House hasn't gotten its final bill, and the Senate hasn't gotten its final bill. But the principles we've talked about is this. If you're happy with your insurance, you get to keep it. And my understanding is we're not going to mess with self-insurance. Because if it's working, why would we?
Okay. The second question I had, you talking about the protesters a while ago. Would you include Code Pink in that group?
Code Pink can be very disruptive. My God, they disrupt me all the time. They come to my hearings on foreign relations and disrupt me. So whether you're from one end of the spectrum or the other, I support your right to have an opinion, but disruption, loud disruption, is very difficult.
Thanks for calling, Brian. One criticism of President Obama has been that he has not been more specific, that he has turned over too much to the Congress to try to come up with a plan in opposition to the manner in which then First Lady Hillary Clinton did. What is the president going to do about that? Is he going to respond with specifics?
I think what the president is doing is remaining flexible. Now, it's difficult, but the reason he's remaining flexible is this. He wants to make sure we make progress. And if he draws a line in the sand, Diane, and says, if these 17 things aren't in here, or 10 or 4, I will never talk to you again.
But what
he
about
wants to
one,
keep it open.
A public option or universal health care that he promised over and over and over again during the campaign?
Well, I think he's been clear. He's laid out principles. He says, first of all, the bill has to be deficit neutral. He's not going to add to the deficit because he views that as a long-term problem. He's going to sign a bill that stresses prevention, that includes insurance reform, so we're not facing these outrageous costs. And he said the best way to deal with that is a public option. He's for that. And so he said, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. That's very important. He said we're going to crack down on medical errors, which cost us $177 billion a year. That's just medication errors. Can you imagine?
What about the claim by the extreme right that counseling older people is akin to counseling euthanasia?
people make things up. In my life, I want to have a choice. If somebody says, when I get to be older, and I'm getting older, Barbara, you might want to think about your end-of-life issues. And I say, you know what? I'm not thinking about end-of-life issues. Thank you for offering. That's what this is. But if you want to talk about
absolutely.
A living will,
absolutely.
All we say in this is what many states say, you can get paid to help have an attorney help you draw up a living will. And if you don't want it, you could tell people, not interested.
You have in your book a character, a talk show host,
mm-hmm.
whose last name is Slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And the show is called The Slaughterhouse.
Yes.
Tell me about him.
Well, he's got this beautiful voice. He is, you know, he spews out a lot of hate. And he's going after this senator in the most hateful way. And actually, you know, in the book, he stirs up a little bit too much hatred. But I will have to say he's one of my favorite characters in the book. I wrote all of his dialogue, his diatribes, and it was really interesting. And I think people will find it amusing. People call him the Slaughter Man.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Tamarack, Florida. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Senator. I have a quick question for
sure.
you. First, I'd like to make a statement. I'm not a birther, and I believe that President Obama is an American citizen, on a side note. And my main issue that I'm calling about is to ask you what needs to happen on the ground in Iraq for our troops to come back. I know that the situation keeps changing, therefore you're going to get politicians that come up with different answers, but the latest that I've heard is that the leader of Iraq wants us to stay a little longer, and so I'm trying to find out what the latest and greatest is on the new date.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for calling, Jim. First, clarify that birther phrase when he's talking about those who believe very strongly that President Obama was not born in this country.
I have nothing to say to the people who think that, because it means they're not looking at the facts. A, the birth certificate. B, the announcement in Hawaii. The whole thing is kind of ridiculous. And, you know, somebody pointed out the other day that it was John McCain who was born in the Panama Canal, and none of these guys ever said a word about it. And funny, the Democrats just wanted to make sure we clarified that that was okay and fine and he could run for president. So it really, I don't have much to say about it. So I'm going to move on to
sure.
Iraq. First of all, I have never heard Nouri al-Maliki ask us to stay, so I don't know what particular speech he was referring to. He said for a long time it's time for Americans to leave, and I think it is. And what will guide me, obviously, the reports on the ground from the military, but my overwhelming belief that we have bled so much and done so much that I already say, and I said a long time ago, we gave the Iraqi people the chance to govern themselves, to rebuild, and anyone who served there, or any of the families that lost people there, or any of those who were wounded there should know, they gave their all to give the Iraqis a chance, and now they have to take that chance and run with it.
I criticize myself for having let this hour go by without grilling you about climate control.
Oh, do you want to?
I want to hear what you
sure.
have to say
sure.
in less than 1 minute.
Surely. Well, the bottom line is there's something facing us called global warming, and the scientists are clear that if we allow the ravages to hit us, our grandchildren will not have a hospitable planet to live on. It's dangerous.
Are you going to get a plan that really moves us forward?
Yes, we will. And I think the president also makes the point this would be a great economic stimulus, because when we do put a price on carbon through the private sector, we will encourage all these alternative energy sources. And it's going to be a whole new economy with new, clean, green jobs. And we will lead the world. As Thomas Friedman said, the country that does this will be the country that leads.
So what about those folks who say, no windmills in my backyard?
Oh, there aren't that many of them.
You think they're going to go
for it? Not very many
it?
Of them, yeah. I think people understand that the fact that we can move away from foreign oil and all these dictators that have a stranglehold on us, I think they will support us.
Barbara Boxer, senator from California. Her latest novel is titled Blind Trust. A really fun read. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.